Just Love on the Catholic Channel,
Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, the host of Just Love. I'm here with Tom Dobbins, and we're with you on this Labor Day weekend. And also, as we look forward next week to the celebration of the birth of Our Lady on September 8th. So Tom has rounded up two guests for us on this show that will kind of deal with both of those important realities, Labor Day. And our first guest will deal with the role of working women in the workforce and some of the issues related to that. And then our second guest will talk about Mary and what do we know about her historically? Why has she become such an important figure in Christian theology and more Christian spirituality, not merely among Catholics, although certainly Catholics place a very, very high role in Mary, but other Christian religions also have a very important role for Mary. So, Tom, thank you for rounding up our guests. I know we always talk about this at the beginning, is so, when does summer begin? When does summer end? So, I'm offering you the opportunity to opine. I love the word opine because it's one of those kind of what I kind of think, fancy words, which why can't we say, you know, I want to know what, Tom, would you tell us what you think about? But if I want to be fancy, Tom, would you opine on the end of summer, please?
Sure, Monsieur. I'll opine a little on the end. I would say on the end of summer. You know, I appreciate this year because it's given us, and I put this in my emails, it's given us like an extra week before what people will air quotes, right? Call the official end of summer, which is Labor Day. And we have that extra little bump between Labor Day. Because usually Labor Day comes at the very end of August, beginning of September, but now we're a little bit into September, so I'm really appreciating that. But as I opine, Monsignor, I am a firm believer the end of summer comes on September 21st, because we do get that little bit of September that you can still get those hot days, and even if you go away during those days, sometimes you get the best of summer because the humidity is a little lower, the water's warmer, so I'm one who says, let's go with the meteorological definition.
All right. I asked your opinion and you're entitled to your opinion, even if it's wrong. Your opinion. I mean, I'm not going to criticize.
That's a good point.
But I go with Labor Day.
Oh, do you?
Labor Day for this reason, because the pace changes. Maybe not the climate,
but
the pace changes. And everybody kind of now expects you to be around all the time. Mm-hmm. And where up until then, if you weren't, they said, oh yeah, it's kind of August, it's summer, people aren't around. But the point that I agree with you completely on is that we did get an extra week of summer.
Mm-hmm.
And with Labor Day being a week later, because It's the first Monday in September, but since the first Monday in September fell at the end because September began on a Tuesday, we did get an extra week. And one of the reasons I liked it, and I can cite two specific things where to people, you know, in the spring or in May, June, you say, you know, we got to get together this summer. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get together with a couple of people this week. So we kind of, our commitment to get together during the summer, even though so I kind of like the extra week. And for me, just speaking a little bit personally, the extra week was very helpful to me because, as I think you know, I don't know if our listeners know, I had cataract surgery this summer on both eyes. So I will say again to our listeners, I will say that, you don't want to have any kind of surgery, but if you're going to have surgery, cataract surgery is pretty routine these days, incredibly successful, and the recovery time is very quick. So, but it still takes a little bit of your time. So that kind of delayed things. And even when, as I did, had a wonderfully good, competent ophthalmologist, it still kind of took a couple of weeks out of the middle of summer. I was kind of going back and forth. So I'm grateful for that extra week of summer. So,
that's awesome, sir.
Did you do anything special this summer, Tom? I mean, I know you did do a little bit of your ice cream stuff and a little bit of questioning of the lack of purity in the cherry vanilla in your ice cream shop. But anything else?
Well, you know, Monsieur, as you may remember, you would ask me if I was planning on any trips, and you may recall one of the trips I mentioned, but you were correct. One of the trips we were kind of floating in the air was a trip to Nepal,
right,
which did not happen, which is probably a good thing.
Right. Yeah, that is.
That would not have been a good thing. Monsieur, like, we looked and I said, there before the grace of God go we, and those poor people in Nepal. That was absolutely
devastating. Tom, why don't we, for one of our upcoming shows, why don't we try to get somebody who's familiar with that situation that we can kind of share with our listeners what was going on there. I heard initially that the Nepal government didn't want any outside help. Did I hear that correctly?
I think you did, Monsignor. And I think the interesting thing is the Nepalese government, and I discovered this when I was looking into going there. They're very, very connected to the Chinese government, almost to the point of being, kind of a subsidiary of them, although they're separate government. So I think it was basically in coordination with the Chinese government, because part of the flood happened in Tibet, which is in China. So I think what happened was they just kind of said, we'll take care of ourselves. But I think the devastation, as we see on the videos, is incredible. So I think they just had to be able to accept the outside help
I did hear subsequently that there was some outside help being so let's get a guess, and let's make sure the guest can speak a little bit about not merely the kind of humanitarian response aid, but what actually happened.
Yes, exactly.
They not knowing much about geology, it does seem to me it was an incredible geological event.
Yes,
and the melting, the glaze. I don't know, but I'd love to learn a little bit more. And I suspect many of our listeners would be appreciative to understand a little bit more what was going on there.
Exactly, Monsieur. So that was going to be my summer plans, but luckily we missed that. So we're probably planning in November to go to Central Europe. So we're going to go instead to Austria and to Budapest. So, a little bit safer than necessarily Nepal.
Ah, okay. Have you been to that part of the world?
I've been to, we're going to Prague and we're going to Budapest, which I've been to both of those, but never to Austria. So we're going to Vienna. So my parents have been, they say it's absolutely beautiful. So I'm very much looking forward to it.
So we'll have a conversation. We can have it either on air or we can have it off air, because I have been to Vienna, I've been to Budapest, and I've been to Prague. So I can, but I will tell you, I went to Budapest kind of, not by mistake, but as a detour.
Okay.
And this is literally true. Many, 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 many years ago, when I was doing a tour of Europe through with Europass, etc.
Okay.
I was with a friend of mine, another priest. He was a seminarian then, now he's a priest, and And we were walking down the street in Vienna, and we saw like one of those sandwich board signs in the street
Oh,
saying,
yeah.
visas to Budapest. So we went into the place and said, what's going on? They said, oh, well, it's a, I don't know, 3-hour train ride or a 2-hour train ride. And I mean, we were on trains forever. So that, and we bought a visa to Budapest.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we went to Budapest. A little bit of a trivia question.
Okay.
Which you probably know the answer to because you know all these things about Budapest.
Yeah.
Do you know what the real name of the city is?
Well, it's, if I'm not mistaken, Monsieur, and I, again, this is being trivia, yeah, there, I think there's actually two cities.
You got it right. So that was a trick question.
Oh, very good. Okay.
City
yes.
Of Buda, right. Buda and the city of Pest.
And Pest, exactly.
So,
yes.
So I think the only thing we have that's a little bit close to that is Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Correct. The Twin Cities, right. Exactly. In Minnesota. Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
No, but I don't think Budapest even puts a hyphen.
No, it's all one word. Every time you look at it, that's why. So unless you really look into it, you would not know that's two cities. Yeah.
All right. So, Tom, let's go to our first guest.
Great, Monsieur.
Who is Ellen Cassidy, who's the founder of the 9 to 5 movement. She is from Boston. The movement began some 50 years ago, and I am delighted. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love. We'd love to hear you.
Great. Very glad to be here.
Oh, that is delighted. So tell us, Ellen, we got a movement, we got a movie, we got a song. What's this 9 to 5 stuff all about?
So back in 1972 in Boston, I was one of 10 women office workers who started out sitting in a circle on our lunch hour talking about our jobs. And we talked about low pay, unequal pay, training men to be our own supervisors, and having to do favors.
That's worth combat pay to do that task.
We had to do favors, all kinds of favors for our bosses. At that time, sexual harassment was perfectly legal. You could be fired for being pregnant. And in the newspapers, there were two columns, help wanted male and help wanted female.
Ah.
So I think we were 20 million strong women office workers, 1/3 of America's female workforce, but we were invisible. And I think
right.
It all came home to us one day when a student walked into our office, looked one of us right in the eye and said, isn't anybody here? Well, I'm here. Can you see me? So at that time in the downtown.
The person student who walked in was male.
Yes, definitely. So at that time in the office workforce, there was very little history of women joining together to make their situation better. If you had a problem, you thought, maybe I should take a class or dress better.
Right.
But the idea of sitting around the table to negotiate with management might have been unimaginable to a lot of people, but we perfected the art of kind of raising a ruckus. And things started to change. And we started winning millions of dollars in raises and back pay across the city of Boston. We went national. We even formed a woman-led union. And I think there were big changes. So we were quite thrilled when Jane Fonda, the celebrated actor, came to us and said she wanted to make a movie about the concerns of office workers. And they brought their team to meet with our members. And they asked a question we had never thought to ask, which was, have you ever fantasized about doing in your boss? Well, there was a moment of stunned silence, and then the room just exploded because it turned out actually everybody had. There was a fantasy about grinding up a boss in a coffee grinder. There was one about.
So Ellen, can I like just interrupt for a moment?
Yes.
That's gender neutral.
Uh-huh.
Because male worker has thought about killing his boss at one point also. So
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So Jane Fonda recruited Dolly Parton, the superstar songwriter and singer, and Lily Tomlin, who was this great comic force. And the three of them became this trio in the movie 9 to 5, which came out in 1980 and was a huge hit.
That is one. And what was the song written to be part of the movie?
Yeah, one day on the set of the movie, Dolly Parton came in and she started clicking her long acrylic nails
Right.
to simulate the sound of typing. And she started singing this song, which was just the perfect embodiment of everything we were talking about. It starts with pride, it goes on to complain about the boss, and then it summons a sense of collective action. You're in the same boat with a lot of your friends. And then it ends in triumph. The tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. And that song has become an enduring anthem.
And was she the composer of the song?
Yes, she wrote the song. And also in the movie, she plays Doralee Rhodes, who is a sweet but very annoyed secretary whose boss is directing a lot of lecherous attention at her.
Right.
And she joins together with her two fellow office workers, and they Well, it becomes necessary for them to kidnap their boss. And but once he's out of the office,
That's an interesting organizing tactic.
exactly. And but once he's out of the office, it's sort of like no one notices. And the office runs much better than it had before, and they start implementing all these policies that we were calling for, like childcare and flex time and job sharing. And the office just worked a lot better than it did with him in it. So the thing is,
Cassidy, who's the founder of the 9 to 5 movement. We're speaking with her about the organizing of women there. But Ellen, I'm gonna share with you a story similar to that, but very different. But I had a summer job in actually in the Bronx County Courthouse, and myself and two other women, when we were college students, were working, and it was like summer job. We were processing papers. We were doing it with a lot of records that were there and stuff like that. And one day, the boss didn't come in. And the boss, I think, was a man. Okay. The boss was a man. And so we went about our business. And literally, I don't mean to pick on anybody, but by 10 o'clock in the morning, we had finished everything we wanted to do. We got this desperate phone call from the supervisor saying, "Just hold on tight. We're going to get you a supervisor there very, very quickly. So don't worry about it." And one of my coworkers, she said, "All right, fine, but we're done." Now, they were absolutely appalled and terrified. That what that the three of us without a supervisor had gotten 8 hours of work done in an hour. They said, "No, you can't do that."
And that's something that the 9 to 5 movie really brought across very strongly, that these were really competent women who knew what they were doing. And it was really the first time that office workers had seen ourselves as the main characters on the big screen. And the atmosphere in the movie theaters was just electric. People were hooting and cheering and standing up in their seats and right on. And it's really something. And I just want to say that shortly after the movie came out, I was on the bus on the way to work and I overheard these two women talking. And one of them was saying to the other, "So I said to him, 'No, I will not make your coffee. I just saw 9 to 5.'"
That we did you actually did you get a cameo in it?
Did we get
Did you
a?
get a cameo in the movie?
Oh, no, we didn't get a cameo. We did have somebody stationed on the set to make sure that they didn't go off the rails. You know,
Okay.
it was very important to us that the movie had to show office workers as competent. They weren't the problem. Someone else was the problem. The boss was the problem. And that the answer to their problems was that they were going to join together. Because when
Oh,
we got
that's
started, we went around, we talked to some union officials, and they said, "Office workers, you can't organize them." But in fact, unions began to spend more attention, pay more attention to office workers. And in fact, women office workers could be organized, and they were.
So how, what's the let's jump a little bit forward now. That's was quite a number of decades ago. Is that chapter, is that union still active?
Yes, it's called District 925, just like 9 to 5, as part of the Service Employees International Union, and it's active in Seattle, Washington. The base is childcare workers and people who work at the University of Washington, and it's a strong, great, terrific union.
But not so many office workers anymore.
Yeah, office workers too, and the 9 to 5 organization itself, the non-union wing of it, is also still active. And there's a need for it because a lot of things have changed since then for the better. Workplace issues that used to be considered individual matters are now matters of policy. Sexual harassment is illegal, pregnancy discrimination is illegal, and managerial jobs are increasingly open to women with college degrees. And within the labor movement itself, women have risen to the top. But there's no denying that actually it can be harder to be a worker today than it was 50 years ago.
And why is that?
We still have low-paying dead-end jobs. They're still with us. And women and people of color are most likely to fill those jobs and remain stuck in them. The gender gap between men and women is stuck. It's been stuck for years at 82%. Now, it used to be worse. It used to be 59 cents to the dollar. Now it's 82. And it's much worse for women of color. People, I'm sure people like this, are working two and three jobs just to make ends meet. And
So, could you help us, since Labor Day is coming up? Could you help our listeners a little bit? Because you use the word gender gap. Give us a little bit of a tutorial. What does that phrase mean?
Well, it means that for the same work, ma a man will get paid more than a woman just because he's a man. Gender gap. So, women earn, as a body, women are earning 82% of what men are earning.
So let me kind of pursue that a little bit. So I don't know, pick a job. Let's say a computer programmer. So does the gender gap kind of mean if a company is hiring, a mid-level computer programmer and they hire a man, the man's going to make 18% more than the woman?
Well, it works two ways. One way is that, a man walks into an interview, a woman walks into an interview, and the interviewer looks them over and says, in the old days, what used to happen, it looked the man say, well, he probably has a family to support, so we'll give him such and such salary. A woman, she's just making what they called pin money, extra, just a contribution to the family. Or she's about to get married, she'll be leaving the workforce soon. All those stereotypes, I think they're not as common anymore, but they still operate. And certainly racial discrimination is certainly still out there too. So that's one thing, just the same job, two different people get different salaries. The other thing that happens is that a job becomes sort of known as a woman's job. And that job doesn't have the same prestige as a job that requires similar skills, but is thought of as a men's job. And the man's job gets more.
Would we consider teaching one of those?
Well, I have so much respect for teachers and daycare workers, and I feel like they deserve the stars in the sky. I think parking lot attendants get paid on average more than daycare workers. And just think about that. What's more important to us, our car or our child? So I
Well,
think.
we can have that debate about why we have more highways than public transit. And I think as a country, we've said cars are more important,
And that's,
but I hear your point. It's well
it's
taken.
disgraceful. And working families are placed under so much pressure. It's unbelievable what families are expected to do. Work starts at 9, so does the school. School ends at 3:30, jobs end at 5. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to patch together all these arrangements, and it's it People need help. And it's not like this in other industrialized countries. The United States is unique in the lack of support to working families.
Yeah. How has the creating of people joining unions and work, it seems to have been impacted a lot by some of the changes. For example, traditionally, I think unions had a lot of members who were members of manufacturing, maybe even mining and stuff like that. Those jobs have gone overseas. And so now it seems that in the organizing or the growth area seems to be more in the public sector than in the private sector. Are there areas of the private sector that you kind of think should be areas that receive more attention in terms of organizing?
Absolutely. I mean, the good news today is that support for unions is at its highest level in two generations.
Right.
Huge percentage of everybody thinks that a union is a good idea, and I agree. So I think just about everybody deserves a union, and it would be better for employees, it would be better for employers, if people had the opportunity to sit down and negotiate over what their jobs are like. And this was something that we realized right away, that people really care about their jobs and they really want them to work well. And
Right.
the story you told is a perfect example of you were like top notch at what you were doing, and you knew how to do it well. And those skills too often are just ignored by management. Just we had a situation once where a law firm decided they were going to redecorate and redesign the office. So Monday morning, the office workers come into work and their chairs are bolted to the floor and they can't reach their typewriters. So, if the workers had had a voice in
Right.
making that change, that wouldn't have happened. And there's so many examples of things like that, that, I think that, it'd be much better if workers had a voice on the job, whatever the job was. And I
Yeah,
think that.
I agree with you. And that, I mean, what I've often said, my experience in working with people is most people want to do the right thing. And they take pride in what they do. They want to get it right. They want to do that. And it seems to me sometimes, we design things for the 5% of workers who want to cheat. And so we create these rigid things to deal with the 5% of quote unquote bad apples. And it punishes the 95% of people who would do a much better job if they weren't so pigeonholed.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. A perfect example is the healthcare industry, where these days, what happens is a hospital will sort of poach nurses from the hospital down the block,
Right.
down the other side of town, try to recruit them to come in, or
Right.
hire workers from overseas. And wouldn't it be great if the orderlies, the people who are working there in the low-level jobs, who really care about how that place works, have a big heart, if they had the opportunity to move up the career ladder and bring all that talent and all that caring into the system.
And I think what you say is that the whole issue of the workforce is touches on so many different things. And again, unfortunately, as noble a profession as teaching is, in many areas, the results in our public schools are not good. And sometimes you have people entering the workforce who maybe are challenged in some of the skills needed to move up in the workforce. And so it's kind of a big societal puzzle in which a lot of pieces need to be aligned in order to kind of move us forward.
Totally agree. I really do. You can't just solve one problem over here without also looking at another problem. And education can't be fixed until the economy is fixed, and the
Right.
economy can't be fixed until education is fixed, and so on. Yeah.
So, Ellen, you've been generous with your time, but before we let you go, Tom and I have a rule that when we have smart people like you on the show, for the last part of the show, we make them the czarina of the whole labor scene. What are the three changes you would like to see happen in the world of labor?
Great question. First of all, I would like to see every single worker look inside and say, I am worth it. I'm going to go get what I deserve. I deserve rights. I deserve respect. Second of all, I would like, as we were just talking about, I would like the value of work and workers to be accepted and celebrated all over the economy. And then for me, I think that, workers operating collectively will be the greatest boon to them and to the economy I could imagine. And I believe it's going to happen. I continue to believe that America's working people are not going to stop coming up with creative new strategies to improve our situation just the way we did 50 years ago.
Hey, you only get a you don't get a but in terms of this. You gotta vote either yay or nay, okay?
That's
You don't get to go AI, yay or nay. I'm sorry, that was unfair. You don't have to do that.
big problems, and I think we have to think very carefully about that AI before we let it into our schools and our workplaces.
So my response, which I would not have been able to answer the question, I would say big opportunity, big problem. It's both an opportunity and it's got and a threat. A big opportunity, a big threat. And we got to figure out how we minimize the threat and maximize the opportunity. I don't know how to do it, but I think that's the goal that we should be at. But anyway, thank you so much, Ellen Cassidy, and thank you for that circle 50 some odd years ago, which kind of got this off the ground. I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for being with us on Just Love.
Great pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you so
Ellen
much.
Cassidy, the founder of the 9 to 5 movement, and which was a woman which began in an office where women sitting around saying, hey, things got to be better here. We know what we're doing, and we should get together to make sure other people know what we're doing and they respect us and the work that we do. Tom, I think it's time for us to take a break. But before we do, we remind our listeners, just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We're speaking about this week, things about labor. We just had a wonderful conversation with Ellen Cassidy about one of the beginnings of the organizing of women office workers in that began in Boston some 50 some odd years ago. And coming up next week is the celebration of the feast of the birth of Mary. And so we're going to speak in a few minutes with Professor Fetter on Mary and the humanity of Mary and what was she really like? What do we know about her from the scriptures or maybe some of the other sources? Hey, Tom, I want to get a little bit of credit that
Okay.
I did not question Ellen Cassidy on her baseball fandom.
That's a good point. Yes, Monsignor, that's actually good. Although I think she was in Boston then. She now lives in New York. So
Okay.
maybe she has dual loyalty.
All
Maybe.
right. Well, but I didn't, I figured, I'll let it go. I'll be kind.
That was very good, Monsieur. That was you get points out of purgatory for that one.
Now, many years ago, one of the co-hosts of the show was George Horton, who Tom knows very well. And Tom and George, unfortunately, always has been on the dark side.
Yes,
he's been a
yes.
Boston Red Sox fan. But I was just sharing with him a couple of weeks ago that, boy, it's become humiliating that now they're talking about the competition of the Yankees and the Red Sox for a wild card place. I mean, that is humiliating. You know,
how can we be in this place?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they wouldn't even talk about winning the pennant or winning the division. It's like, well, maybe they'll make the wild card. They got a good shot at the wild card. That's horrendous. Anyway, all right, so let's go to our next guest. Our next guest is Professor Julia Fetter. She is the acting director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality. She's associate professor of religious studies and theology at St. Mary's College. Professor Fetter, thank you for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. So would you give our listeners just a little bit of your own background? How'd you wind up? Where'd you grow up? How'd you wind up doing what you're doing now? Just a little bit of interest so they can put a little bit of color behind the voice that they hear.
Sure. Both of my parents are from Philadelphia.
Okay. That's one of our nicest suburbs from New York.
Well, and I, my mother was an Italian Catholic who grew up in South Philadelphia, and my dad grew up in Philadelphia as in a Jewish family and is Jewish. We had an interreligious family growing up. I grew up mostly though in southern New Jersey at the beach in Ventnor, New Jersey. And so a great community filled with lots of Italian Catholics, Irish Catholics, Latino Catholics, and lots of Jews. So
and Ventnor is a place where a number of communities of women religious have a house or something. So
yes,
you probably ran into a few of them down in that neck of the woods too.
It's a wonderful place to rest and relax. So that's not surprising.
Yeah, it is. It is. So then after you kind of got done lolling around the beach and you decided you were going to do something productive with your life, what'd you then do?
I went to college at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And then I just kept doing education. I did a master's at Boston College in theology and then PhD at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. And I still live in this area. I went to Creighton University for 6 years as professor in between, but
okay.
I'm back in Indiana.
So before you were born, I think a couple of people who taught in your institutions also taught me when I was in the seminary.
Mm.
So I think Father Robert Imbelli went up to Boston College and he taught me when I was in the seminary.
He was also my teacher, yes.
And then
at Boston College, yes.
And then another one of my my professors went out to Notre Dame and taught scripture in the theology department out of there, a John Meyer.
I've met him, I did meet him, but he was never my teacher. Yes.
Right. So,
excellent scholar.
Yep. So anyway, and then after you went out to Notre Dame, you walked across the street to St. Mary's. Is that what happened?
Yes. Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah, St. Mary's College is a Catholic women's institution. And so we really, you know, while Notre Dame became, it was originally a men's only institution, it became co-ed in the early 1970s, but St. Mary's College remained a women's institution. And I think really tries to live into that the questions and the experiences that women have in unique ways. So it's a really interesting place to be, and not unusual then that we're doing some thinking about Mary here. I think that's a normal, it's hard to grow up Catholic, especially as a Catholic woman, and not think about Mary.
Okay, so what do you think about Mary?
Well, it's interesting, you know, I think she is someone who is lifted up to Catholics in general as a model of what it means to be a faithful follower of Jesus, but with women in a particular way, for better and for worse, right? I remember being a kid and being in Sunday school, and my Sunday school class was going to have a pool party, and my Sunday school teacher told us that none of the girls should wear two pieces to the pool party because Mary never wore a two piece. And I was confused because I didn't think Mary wore any bathing suits. So I wasn't sure what we should wear to the pool party, but
So are you saying Mary went skinny dipping?
Maybe, probably if she went swimming, she did.
Okay. I just want to clarify what you anyway, so you know, oftentimes I think when we look at the scriptures and we do get a lot of stuff written into them that's not there. But from your kind of understanding, what is it we know about Mary, the human Mary, from the scriptures or other text from the same time? What can we really say about her?
Yeah, we don't know a lot about Mary from the Gospels, from the canonical Gospels.
Right.
We know a few things. So we do know that she had a special relationship with her son, Jesus. Right. We know that she was present at a lot of the very important moments in Jesus's life. Of course, she was present at his birth. She was also present at his crucifixion. She was present in the upper room when the Holy Spirit descended upon his followers. And in fact, we also know that because of her earliest experiences in trying to understand that she was going to give birth to Jesus, that when the Holy Spirit descends upon his community, this was not a new experience for her. She had already experienced the gift of the Holy Spirit with the Annunciation, with the announcement that Jesus was going to be born to her. So these are some things that we know about the Gospels, but we don't know a lot about the rest of her life. There are some other texts in the Christian tradition that talk in more depth about Mary. They were never ended up being included in the Bible. So for example, the Proto-Evangelium of James, or sometimes it's called the Gospel of James, that's a text from the second century. So written around the same time or a little bit later than some of the biblical texts, but it was never included in the Bible. And that's a text that actually tells the story of tells another story of Jesus's birth, and also tells the story of Mary's birth. That's been, despite it not being included in the Bible, lots of art and storytelling throughout the Christian tradition has been drawn from this particular text, the Proto-Evangelium of James. So it's inspired lots of traditions about Mary. So for example, that we honor Mary's parents as Anne and Joachim, that comes from the Proto-Evangelium of James. That's not in the Bible at all. And yet we revere those Anne and Joachim as saints. In some parts of the world, their feast day is celebrated as a kind of grandparents' day, because they would have been grandparents of Jesus. So there's lots of stuff that's pulled from these non-canonical texts.
We're speaking with Professor Julia Fetter of St. Mary's College in Notre Dame. And we're speaking about Mary. So what does the two of the passages in the scripture where there's a little bit of tension between Jesus and Mary, what do they tell us? Do they tell us anything about Mary? The two passages I'm referring to is when John's gospel has Mary ask Jesus to do something about the lack of wine at Cana. And Jesus kind of says, don't bother me. I mean, my translation of the Greek, don't bother me. I'm not ready yet. And then the other part where he basically says, when they tell him that his mother's outside, he says, no, these are my family who are in here. What does that tell? Does that tell us anything about Mary and what's going on?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think this tension remains in the Christian tradition. So on the one hand, Jesus has this very special relationship with his mother. At the wedding at Cana, in fact, he does sort of rebuke her, but he ends up listening to what she says.
Right.
He does what he asks her to do. And so there is this pull that she has on him. His biological relationships are important to him. He doesn't end up leaving all of his family ties behind. And yet, on the other hand, it's very clear with that second story that you're talking about, where he says, he's saying to those who have gathered around him, he says, you know, these are my family. This is a basic tension in the Christian tradition, that when we join the church, when we become part of this Jesus movement, we create these new family bonds, and they don't displace or replace our biological bonds, but these are also bonds that are important. And when these bonds come in conflict with each other, we have this tradition of people throughout the Christian tradition who have chosen fidelity to the church, who have chosen fidelity to what they understand as the call of Jesus over what their families would have wanted them to do. So we have lots of stories about, you know, saints who, you know, their mother or father is pleading with them, please don't give everything that you have to the poor. Please don't, you know, allow yourself to be killed by the emperor. Please don't upset everything that we know about life. And they do it anyway, because out of fidelity to Jesus. So I think that there is this tension in the Christian tradition. I think these stories are trying to play with that tension.
Right. Why do you think, my opinion may disagree, I think Mary has been much, much more important for Catholic spirituality than for Catholic theology. Why do you think Mary has taken such a very, very important place in Catholic spirituality?
Yeah, it's definitely true that Mary has played a really dynamic role in Catholic spirituality throughout the world. I mean, she's often a figure who has become enculturated into the local traditions, the local dress, the local just flavor of a people. Yeah. So I think about, for example, of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who appeared to Juan Diego in the 16th century as an indigenous woman, and really communicated to Juan Diego and therefore all of the people, the colonized folks of Mexico, that their culture and their identity wouldn't die with colonization, that something would live on and continue on. I think also of the way that Our Lady of Guadalupe has continued to inspire throughout Latin America resistance to colonizing and violent forces. So I think about my colleague Laurel Potter, who has been doing some work with grassroots resistance movements in El Salvador, who have taken this image of Our Lady of Guadalupe as a model for their resistance and resilience in the face of their children being disappeared by the powers that be. And they claim Mary as somebody who also had a son who was disappeared. So I think it's true that there's this really intense and interesting dynamism in Catholic spirituality and the spirituality of real people on the ground. I think in theology, there's sometimes a nervousness about Mary displacing the importance of Jesus. And so there's this hesitancy to put too much on Mary doctrinally because Christians, of course, believe that Jesus is God incarnate, and that Mary is one of us. She's our sister in the faith. She's a member of the church. And so there's, but I think that difference can also be another creative tension, like another place where we can see some interesting and creative things emerge.
Professor Julia Fetti, you've been so generous with your time and your insights. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for the work you're doing in spirituality and theology. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you.
Great. Tom, we'll take a break. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome to Back to Just Love. I hope you have a very good Labor Day weekend, and I hope we celebrate with great proper prayer and reverence the Feast of the Nativity of Mary next week. Thank you for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, neighbor, self, and create a more just and compassionate world. We're on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel,
Sirius XM 129.